My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. That was a hell of an introduction. I don't know if I even want to talk now. I just kind of like to sit over there and revel in that introduction. That sounds pretty good. The only thing I can go is if I don't tell the truth, y'all will recognize it, and I guess I could go down like a big old flaming dirigible. I'm really privileged to be here. My home group is a men's group, and next week we'll have our retreat. And there are 150 men in that group. Two of the nights a month we have a speaker meeting, and two nights we have a discussion meeting. Someone has said, how do you have a discussion meeting with 150 people? Well, we do it. And it has worked very, very well for almost 20 years. So to be in a retreat for men is just incredible for me. I've always, interestingly enough, I've always had a great love affair with men. I'm not gay, but even if I were, it's not that big a deal with me one way or another. But the fact is that I'm not. But I've been deeply in love with men for pretty much my whole life, from the time I played, my first football game when I was in fourth grade. And to just be around the strength, the power, the testosterone, and the only thing stronger, at least that I've seen in this group and in the group that I'm in at home, is the spirituality. And to see testosterone directed by spirituality, it really does move a lot of rocks. And I absolutely enjoy being around it, more than I can tell you. This film that Bill Cosby did, I'm really grateful it showed it, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was amusing. I really laughed just like you did through most of it. I'm sure there's some people in this room that didn't laugh. I'm sure they really are, and you would think most of them would be in their very early sobriety, and that may be true. And I was just having the best time laughing at this thing and relating to what was going on until he started puking. And it really did fascinate me because my stomach started rolling. And I'm sitting there, and you know, I by the grace of God and the power of God and the big book and the steps and home group and good sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. And I put those together for almost 30 years, and I don't know that my stomach has rolled in forever. And I sit there and think, my God, I'm going to throw up. I mean, I'm dead serious. And what it reminded me of and the message that comes from this, you know, we teach each other in recovery to change playmates, playpens, and playthings. And I can't tell you how significant that is was in my life, and I think it is in every one of our lives, to change playmates, playpens, and playthings. Because the same mechanism that made my stomach roll is the same mechanism that will make that cocaine and that alcohol dance and that relationship vibrate. And all the environment that goes into the milieu of the drink or the drug. As Bill said, I've been privileged to work with thousands of people. I mean really privileged to work with thousands of people as a physician, then running the physician's health program for the state of Kentucky, where we've seen almost 2,000 doctors, and being one of the medical directors of a homeless shelter where we sleep 400 men and women a night and have 300 of them in a year-long program of recovery, and in years that I've spent in the prisons. And I think I can say with a lot of experience and maybe some conclusions that I don't think are necessarily just opinions, but I really think they're experiences. This disease goes deeper than any of us can ever imagine, even for someone like me that spent the last 20 years studying it. Not to try to figure out what to do about my alcoholism. I learned that quickly in AA. But I'm fascinated with what Wilson was fascinated with, this disease, this malady. I can tell you that none of us even remotely fathom the depth of this disease and its power. And that in those thousands of people that I've seen, especially with the cocaine addicts, they can cue, I'm not a cocaine addict, I'm an amphetamine addict. And I spent 12 years out there in field trials with that. And 8 years Yeah, 8 years with alcohol, and I'll talk about this in my story because they were at two different times in my recovery and in my life. And it's interesting to compare the journeys because they were really completely isolated. 12 years of amphetamine, no alcohol. 8 years of alcohol, no amphetamine. And a lot of the things that I experienced with amphetamine, the cocaine people have shared with me, and I'm able to share with them. And I got to tell you, I've seen cocaine people cue off the dollar bill. The same mechanism that made my stomach roll will make a dollar bill vibrate or make talcum powder vibrate. We even found that it was very difficult to show movies to cocaine addicts about cocaine early in recovery, early being for the first 3 to 6 months sometimes, because their stomach would roll. I'm talking about me, but it's the same mechanism. That wasn't going to be part of my story, but I was so impacted with sitting there watching him puke and feeling what I went through and realizing what that's akin to that I really needed to share it with you. I really needed to share it with me. You've asked me to come tell you a story. That story is what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And let me make sure that I emphasize what I'm like today. If my experience means anything, the evolution of this recovery process, I'm sure that virtually everything that you've taught me and that I've been more than willing to learn will continue to be real solid tools, but there's so much more for me to learn. And there's so much more for me to experience. And I really do embrace the fact that today I know a lot and I've experienced a lot, but there's so much more. And I look forward to it. Afraid I'm going to run out of life and die. I'm on 2 banana peels. I've had more heart disease and Carter's got liver pills. And like to die about a year and a half ago from all kinds of complications. So I may not get to stay that much longer. But during the time that I'm here, if my life continues to evolve as it has, what a ride. What a ride. This story I'm going to tell you may not be your story. My wife quit drinking when I quit drinking and went to Al-Anon. 6 years later, she came into AA because she heard her story. It took her 6 years to hear her story. So this may not be your story on how you got here. I hope that I'll spend enough time on recovery, and I'd like to, and I think I will, that story I hope will be the same for you. Because it's really, this isn't rocket science. It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Well, recovery is the second hardest thing I've ever had to do. The hardest thing I ever had to do was drink and take drugs like a normal person. I don't know what the hell a normal person does with drugs. I don't know why they'd be out snorting cocaine, but assuming they were normal. I've never seen a recreational cocaine user. I'm sure there's one that exists, but I've never seen it. They just haven't played in their last game yet, is what the deal is on that. I've found that recovery in each of us, this has been my observation, is a very much an individual journey. If I talk tonight and you sit there and think, well, hell, I got more recovery in him, then you're screwed. If you sit there tonight and think, I'll never have what he's got, then you're screwed. It's an individual journey. What I also know is, at least for an alcoholic of my type, it must never be taken alone. An alone journey for an alcoholic of my type is worse than being in shark water. It just is worse than being in shark water. An alcoholic of my type doesn't make it alone. But you and I may not get to the same intersection at the same time, even if we're following and using the same owner's manual. But we'll get there and continue over and over to get there. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking bleach in the Mayfield City Jail in 1935. He was the town drunk. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She was what we call today an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, if you have a problem with that therapeutic term, just go read the first page of The Family Afterward. It said if you're around one of us, in essence, if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. And my mother was neurotic, one of the neatest people I've ever known. My mother died in 78. I adored her when she was alive. I adore her and miss her since she's been dead. But my mother was a goofy little lady. Now, she should have been goofy with what she went through. And there was no resolution to the shame and the rage and the guilt and the resentments and all the pain that she felt. Fortunately, she was a devout member of the church. And the church kept her from just basically flying off the planet. And I'm really sure of that. Because Mother has the same problem that I've got, and that's chronic anxiety. I mean, I've lived with anxiety all my life. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, I imagine most of you are, then you just live in a constant state of anxiety, more or less. And Mother certainly lived that way, and thank God for the church. I learned, in my home was the first place I learned about conditional love. If I made A's and walked straight and was the best kid possible, the perfect kid, she'd pat my ass, part my hair, and made me king baby. It was there. I was sharp enough, and as the book says, sensitive enough, when it says, as alcoholics, we are sensitive people. And I was sharp enough and sensitive enough that I picked up quickly how to get what I wanted more than anything else. I don't know where this started, but it's been with me as long as I can remember. That if you're perfect and do everything that they want you to do, they'll take care of you and make you feel special. The second best thing that Bill Wilson ever wrote, as far as I'm concerned, for me, after the big book, was a letter he wrote in 1953 called Emotional Sobriety. And in that letter, what he said to the man he wrote it to was he had found that all of, he was 18 years sober. Now, he actually alludes to this in the big book, but it shows you how recovery evolves. He really had an insight into it 18 years later, or 15 years later, when he said that he'd found all of his problems were money, power, prestige, sex, approval. The seeking of approval. I don't know how many men I've worked with, but I've never worked with one that in one way or another wasn't looking for approval. Virtually always looking for approval of some dominant male. It works beautifully in our program with sponsorship. And my sponsor told me it was okay to seek his approval. He said, you'll get it when it's appropriate. But he said, it's okay to seek it. And he called my wife in. I haven't told this in a long time. He called my wife in, and I'd been sober 4 months. Been home from treatment for about a month. He called my wife in. He said, when Burns starts acting up, this guy wasn't a devout member of Al-Anon, but he was a devout member of AA. He called my wife in. He said, when Burns starts acting out, you call me. And Burns, you give her permission to call. I said, well, hell, I'll call you. And he said, no, you won't. I said, why? And he said, because you want my approval. And that'll mean more to you than anything as this goes along. But it is a thread that I'm absolutely certain may be at the very core of most of the pathology and most of the character defects that I have, is the seeking of approval regardless of the cost. And what I can tell you today, when I was growing up and even and early in recovery, and certainly when I was drinking, you could own me with a word of praise or a word of criticism. Either way, you owned me. Today, you can bloody my nose and you can make me cry, but you can't own me. Through this program, I've learned I'm a child of God that has been given the grace of recovery and the responsibility to pass it on. But you can't own me. I want to be a part of you and will be. But I'm a child of God who happens to be given to you. So I first learned about conditional love with my mother. Be perfect and you will get approval. This is the first place I ever came, Alcoholics Anonymous, where it told me not only did I not have to be perfect, I couldn't be perfect, and gave me a set of rules and tools to follow to help me deal with the fact I would never be perfect. The second place I learned about conditional love was the church. And that wasn't what I thought they said. It's what they said. You believe this or you'll go to hell. And hell is a flame about this tall, you're about that tall, and it's going to burn your ass for a long, long time. I mean, that's what they said. Now, I need to make sure you understand my relationship with the church, because there's certainly no resentment. I grew up with a string of medals for 12 years that I never missed Sunday school and church. Thank God, because when I sat with a 12-gauge shotgun in my mouth in 1977, if it hadn't been for many of those things I learned in my home and many of those things I learned at the church, I wouldn't be here with you today. And when I came back from treatment, the first thing I did is sit down with my best friend, who was an Episcopal priest. And we drank beer together and played golf together. I wasn't an Episcopalian at that time. And I said, "Jimmy, take me back to my church." He said, "Burns, I can do that. But you have to go to AA." Well, I'd been taught that in treatment in Atlanta. I knew I had to go to AA. He said, "AA has better success with alcoholics than the church does." Here's a man with a cloth on. And if you don't think that meant a lot to me, just read Bill Wilson's life. Wilson absolutely adored preachers. And at least I think I know why, because so did I. Because I thought they had a secret, and I needed to find out what that secret was. Jimmy said, "I'll take you back to your church." So for 8.5 years, I attended 4 to 6 AA meetings a week. And I administered the chalice and the host and was a lay reader in the Episcopal Church. At 8.5 years, my sponsor, Jimmy, and myself, sat down and we prayed, because I asked them to help me know what my ministry would be. We call it service, but doctored up theologically, this is a ministry. No question in my mind. And I asked, where would my ministry be? I said, I will go to seminary if y'all think I should. I don't want to go, but I'll go. I'll even be a medical missionary, and I will go down to Bolivia. This is where the hot spot was at that time, and I will minister to those people. After much prayer, my wife was in the room. We decided, it took us a day, and we decided that my ministry would be in Alcoholics Anonymous. This would be my home. This would be my church. You would be my fellow members, and we would worship together. And thank God that was the decision, because this is where I ought to be. This is where I want to be. This is what I embrace. But that's the second place I learned about conditional love. Now, let me tell you one that you'll appreciate. In Sunday school, I was 12 years old, and in Sunday school, they would teach me that it's better to spill your seeds in the belly of a whore than on the ground. Well, I'm 12 years old, and I got a couple of things going against me. I'm only making a quarter a week, and there ain't no whores in Mayfield that I can get for a quarter a week. Now, that's the first. Second thing is, I'd done found me a pool toy, right? I'm 12 years old. Yeah. And I've got a real big conflict here. You know, on one hand, I love what it feels like, but I'm feeling like I'm going to go right to hell with that tall flame. And every Friday and Saturday, or damn near every night, I'd masturbate. Come down to church on an altar call, and they'd baptize me on Sunday night. I've been baptized more than most of you ever had a glass of water. I mean, and I'm really grateful, because that shame and that guilt and that confusion and that inability to be perfect and my fear of disapproval from God on down was eating me up. Was eating me up. Deep in all of this approval seeking and the shame. Now, this didn't make me an alcoholic. Wilson says the real alcoholic is bodily and mentally different. That's exactly how he defines the real alcoholic. My specialty for the last 20 years has been addiction medicine. The people around the country think that I really know my stuff from the science. What they really don't know is I know my stuff from being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how we think, how we feel, how we believe, how we walk, how we talk. I know about this drunk right to the core. And I can put on this wall all the formulas to show you what Bill Wilson would have absolutely been hysterical in glee looking at. This malady that he talked about. The first scientific textbook on alcoholism was the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. It taught us more about this disease than any other textbook we've ever had. Years before it was ever going to be able to be proved scientifically. They taught us that we have a physical allergy and mental obsession. Absolutely right. That we're irritable, restless, and discontented till we get a drink. Silkworth called us that because he didn't know how to talk about ADD, mood disorders, an affective problem. I mean, I'm not against it. Hell, we got to categorize these sumbitches some way, you know. But the fact is, we're irritable, restless, discontented. And we're irritable, restless, discontented because we're born to court low. And I can put the names of the chemicals up here for you. We're a court low. We're bodily different. And Silkworth and Wilson looked at this, and what an incredible recording they gave us as to the simplicity of this malady. They just didn't have the methodology and the paradigms to do the research. But boy, they saw what they saw, and they recorded it clearly. They say that they were the first people to say this is a progressive malady. First place it said young people would drink differently from old people. That women would be affected much more quickly physically than men. All that's in our textbook. And today we've got books written about why that's true. Magnificent. No, I'm an alcoholic because I'm bodily and mentally different. Alcohol will never work in me ever, ever, ever like it does in a normal person. My track record shows it, and what I've observed in everyone else shows it. And I can stack another one on top of that. No other mood-altering chemical works in me like a normal person. A year ago, I went in because of a perforated diverticulum. They had to take out my sigmoid colon a year and a half ago. We were all patting each other on the ass and on the back saying, what a great thing. They got in there through a laparoscope, took out my sigmoid colon, didn't have to crack my belly, and everything looked great. Except 2 days later, I had multiple blood clots in my lungs. Almost died. I was in there for a month. Got ready to send me home, and I had a heart attack. They decided that was a little one. I'm not sure what the hell that is, but that was a little one. May have been little to them. You know? So I go home, and a week later, and I won't go into how this happened scientifically, I had a massive heart attack. Back in the hospital almost for 3 weeks. So I spent almost 2.5 months in the hospital, and they were poking me with Dilaudid intravenously. Should have been. I was in trouble up to my neck. They were giving me exactly what they should have been giving me. When I walked in that hospital, I called my addiction psychiatrist, and my sponsor knew it. Of course, my wife's in recovery. I had the whole support system praying, and I was ready because I knew when they rolled my little ass out of that hospital that whatever drugs they was giving me were going to have me. I wasn't worried about it. They had to give me the medicine, but I wasn't going to come out of there normal. And I didn't come out of there normal. They just sacked me up in a car and took me down to Alabama and put me in an inpatient detox. And I went through 2 weeks of inpatient detox. Shake, rattle, and roll. I wouldn't give you two hoots in hell for every opiate that's ever been made. But man, it had me by the short hairs and was pulling. I wasn't upset. I was just addicted. Well, actually, they call it physiological dependency. As opposed to addiction, that's how we do when we're addicted, when we steal things. I wouldn't steal anything, I'd just sit in there mumbling. So no mood-altering drug works in me like it does in a normal person, and that's just the way that it is. And if you think, well, do I get to take medicine if I'm in pain? Well, of course you do if you know the way to deal with it. Hell, I had a vasectomy 3 months in sobriety. And I went in there like the little Turk that they sent home from treatment. And thank God they taught me this. And I'm going to do it under local. Now, I'm sure some of you heroes have had vasectomy under local. Well, this is one hero who tried. Let me tell you what happened. They stuck that needle in my testicle. And I thought, oh, shit, wrong choice. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't even in my testicle, but they were close enough that it might as well have been. And so I passed out and stayed passed out for 2 hours because every time I got up, my blood pressure went to zero. You know, it's a medical word for that. But I called my sponsor and I said, I had a vasectomy. I didn't take any medication. He said, you're an idiot. just my experience, strength, and hope that I'm sharing. No, it didn't make me an alcoholic, but let me tell you what it did. It established the thinking. And I was taught clearly that when you stop the drinking, if you don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. You stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. And my thinking started way back then. Wilson, in the fifth chapter in the fourth step, not only he literally directs us to go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. He takes me all the way back. Stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking. You go back to the drinking. And that's the age-old story. And that's what we're here about. At least I am, to deal with this thinking of resentments, of fears, of shames, of dishonesty, of self-centeredness. We spent this whole weekend together on studying this book. Praise God. Because when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that wasn't the marching order in Louisville, Kentucky. I spent 10 years in this program, never opened the book, and never did the steps. Because I wasn't taught to. I wasn't defiant. I wasn't taught to. The marching orders in Louisville at that time was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you. He'll tell you what to do. Then you do it and then go save a drunk. Left out that muddled middle. And at 10 years in this program, which I'll get to telling you what happened, I was crazier than a goat. I became a lethal weapon for God. They said, here he comes, drink a beer, he's going to drag your ass off treatment anyway. Here he comes. And the people that I got into treatment, they came back to where I was, stayed a very short period of time, and got the hell out of there, you know. We had a group together, about 15 of us, and we were called, my sponsor was named Raleigh. He's dead, Jim Raleigh. And we were called Raleigh's Raiders. Because we knew what was right. Your problem was bend over and make sure you get all of it given to you, you know. And I'm not deviating from the way it was. I mean, it's humorous, and it worked for me, and I wouldn't trade Jim Raleigh for a herd of ponies. But he was a sick son of a bitch. That's what he was. But I'll tell you what he was. He was my sick SOB. God was sent him to me as clearly as I'm looking at y'all today. He sent this man because of some special gifts or character defects that he had that would keep me under his thumb, and God, I needed to be under somebody's thumb. What I learned from Jim Raleigh in 10 years was not anything about the book or the steps, damn little about AA except go to meetings, but what I did learn was obedience. Obedience. He said jump, and I did it with or without music. That's exactly what I did. I learned to be obedient. That was really tough. A guy my size who's a doctor with a very flourishing practice and a high profile in the community. Man, I had at least 50 people a day telling me I walked on water. And if they didn't tell me that, I just thought they implied it. And I needed somebody to keep knocking me off of that pedestal. And even if it was vicious at times, I learned a very significant lesson. And take away with it what you will. Obedience, obedience, obedience. Alcohol and drugs were no problem for me in high school. They were no problem for me in college. I started medical school in 1958 at the University of Louisville. Now, this part of my story is about drugs. I'm a card-carrying, commode-hugging, 12-gauge shotgun in the mouth, quart of whiskey a night drunk. But I'm going to talk to you about drugs for a while because it's my only story. And not only do I not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it, I've found, as the book says, this is my greatest gift. I've done fifth steps with people, and out of the things that I've walked through, as many of you have too, you were able to let this person know that they weren't the lowest piece of scum that ever came down the pike. And you've seen it repeatedly, and you've done fifth steps where someone told you their experience, strength, and hope with that. So all I know about my story is what I have come to believe is what God gave me. No one respects the traditions more than I do. They could not. No one respects anything in this program more than I do. The singleness of purpose. But I've checked with New York. I've checked with all three sponsors I've had over the years. I've checked everywhere I can, and I've prayed like hell about it. And I need to tell you, I'm real clear today with what my story is. It's what I've been given. And this part of my story is about drugs. When I reached my freshman year in medical school, I was really going to pieces about the first gross anatomy exam, and some of the upperclassmen came down, and one of them didn't gave me this little capsule called amphetamine. He said, take it, and it'll help you stay awake. Now, I didn't know what it was. I didn't take it to get high. That's what everybody took amphetamine at that time in medical school, to stay awake and study. I took that amphetamine, and my life changed. I never knew that the world was loud. That was my world. I lived in it. I didn't know it was loud. And when I took that amphetamine, the world got quiet. I was focused. I was motivated. I had virtually no fear. The textbooks didn't intimidate me. Competition didn't intimidate me. I mean, I had found a wonderful way to live. And it really was. I started taking it virtually daily within a couple of months, and I took it daily throughout my entire medical school career. 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year in 1962, I was kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I hit one of my professors. They considered that bad form in medical school, so they took me down to see the dean and the head of the Department of Psychiatry. And Dr. Keller looked at me, and he said, Burns, what's your problem? And I said, Dr. Keller, I take too many drugs. And he said, do you believe that? I said, yes, sir. And he said, we can help you. What are you going to do? We're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. I saw two psychiatrists a week, one in Nashville, one in Louisville, for almost 2 years, a year and a half. Psychiatry helped me. Psychiatry brought me some things, a lot of crap that went on about it, but they brought me some interesting things. They were the first place to tell me that anger was not a primary feeling. It was a result of resentment or fear. That was taught to me by a psychiatrist in 1964, in 1963. It's interesting what we do with it when we get it into our format, but it's the same basic principle as looking at this anger and where it stems from. And virtually all my anger comes from resentment or fear. Almost invariably, and we have the solution to that. It's called the steps and a process. So psychiatry helped me. After about 2 years of taking psychiatric therapy, they let me back in medical school, and I walked in ready to go. I'd reviewed all my books. I was ready to go. I mean, I was clean. Walked into the old Louisville General Hospital, and in less than an hour, I was strung out on amphetamine again. Just sat on the steps of the medical school and cried because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I'd had state-of-the-art psychiatric care. Now, if you're thinking you know what was wrong, and if you really don't know, let me tell you what I've come to believe. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. AA has never shied from knowledge. We've sought it. Putting into the spiritual process, it is an incredible tool. The knowledge that we have sought within the spiritual process. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. They didn't bring me the spiritual solution. For a drunk of my type, for a drug addict of my type, without the spiritual solution, I've got no hope. And my experience tells me that. When I went to treatment in 1977, I'd had 9 years of psychiatric therapy and been deacon in 5 churches. And was drinking a quart of whiskey a night and couldn't stop. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. I'm not anti-therapy. God knows I'm not anti-therapy. I'm anti-ignorance on both sides of this fence, AA as well as the therapeutic community. And I can walk in both. I can work with the therapists who try to treat us to make sure, if at all possible, they come in contact with me and the system we've set up, that they know what this disease is and what therapy should be done with us. I can also come to an AA meeting and beg people to quit practicing medicine if they don't have a license. Because we got a shitload of them in here practicing medicine without a license. Now, don't get me wrong, the doctors have screwed us for years, so I really understand why that we are so fearful. But I've sponsored 6 schizophrenics and 5 true bipolars. Not this chicken shit bipolar stuff. I'm talking about big time. And if I'm stepping on toes, you ain't getting no virgin. And I don't mean to step on any toes. I swear I don't. But I also can no longer shy away. I ain't got that much time left, guys. No shit. I got to get all this stuff out before I leave unless I write it down. And I sponsor those people because I've watched them. I've watched the horror of some of those people be told to quit their medicine. We've got some real gurus traveling this country talking from the podium about medicine. It sure enough is an outside issue, and that's bad enough, but it's an outside issue with stupidity. And there, now we got a bunch of medicine we shouldn't have, but I can tell you during the time I've been in this field, we've got better medicines than we've ever had. The real deal is that probably only about 3 to 5% of us need medicine. But we damn well better not miss it on that 3 to 5. Because the suicide rate in our population is about 25% greater than it is in the normal population. And man, I know what suicide is. Anyway, I got kicked out of medical school, went to a psychiatrist, so I got back in medical school. My classmates enabled me. They didn't tell anybody I was taking drugs. And I graduated in 1964, went into my residency and internship. I was put in the mental hospital 5 times, strapped down, IV fluids, straight jackets, padded cells. I'd get crazier than a goat on that amphetamine, taking amounts that I won't even tell you because you think I'd be lying. Hell, I may be, but that's the way I remember it. I think that's what I was taking. It's a good figure, and anyway, it makes a good story if I tell it, but I quit telling it. But they'd put me in there and strapped me down. I finally got finished my internship and residency and went into private practice, and the Vietnam War was raging, and I was in the doctor's lounge one day, and I was higher than a kite on amphetamine, raising hell about the Vietnam War. Win it or come home. Sounds a lot like what we're talking about today, doesn't it? Win it or come home. Whatever it is, let's stop this dude. And one of my good friends looked at me and said, hell, if you feel that strongly about it, why don't you join the Army? By God, that's a good idea. I went out and got in the car and drove to Frankfurt, to our capital, and I went there as Dr. Brady and came back as Captain Brady. Didn't call my wife, didn't call my office, didn't call anybody. Just went and joined the Army. And the next 3 psychiatrists who saw me all said I had an impulse disorder. Well, show me a drunk without one, and I'll show you somebody's just trying to get into our fellowship but isn't going to pay the price. Anyway, so I got in the Army, almost got put in Leavenworth. Post commander came down and said, Burns, quit taking that amphetamine, because if you don't, I'll have to court-martial you. So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit. So I quit taking that. Now, it's an interesting thing about that. With my drug period, if the consequences got strong enough, I could quit. And I've seen this repeatedly with most drug addicts. Now, it's not nothing's 100%, but I've seen this with most drug addicts, that if the consequences get severe enough, at least in many, generally in their history of drug addiction, they can quit. They can't stay quit without, at least in my experience, without coming to us and working with us. But in my alcoholism, I reached a point in time where I couldn't quit drinking no matter what the consequences were. I could not quit drinking. Nothing mattered except to try to drink and stop the pain. Nothing mattered. Nothing. Kids, mother, daddy, wife, nothing. Practice, nothing. I couldn't quit. So I came home, got back on the drugs, started my office again in Louisville in 69, got back on the drugs, had a gallbladder attack, went into one of the hospitals, they took out my gallbladder, and the surgeon is a good friend of mine, the internist is a good friend of mine, we held hands and prayed that I'd quit taking amphetamine. My last amphetamine was 1969. Then I started drinking. The first 4 years of my drinking wasn't alcoholic. I got drunk a lot and drank a lot of whiskey, but I didn't start my day thinking about drinking or not drinking. I didn't start my day thinking about getting drunk or not getting drunk. It was not an obsession with me. Literally, it played no part in my life. I just drank a lot, got drunk a lot, but never thought about it. Next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. When I got up at 7 in the morning, I knew when my first drink was going to be. I didn't drink as much whiskey. I didn't get drunk as often, but I drank every day, and I knew when my first drink would be. It'd be at 4:30. I had a very successful practice. I had one partner. I got there early enough to see my patients and even extras, because at 4:30, I was walking out that door. If that damn waiting room was full, he had to see them. Because I was walking out that door right over to the 7-Eleven, got me a quart of beer, put it between my legs, drove 25 miles home drinking that beer. When I got there, I went and got my scotch and water and got smooth. Y'all remember smooth? Hell yes, you do. That's why you're at this retreat. You remember smooth. And that is that thing that comes back, the smooth. The horror gets diluted. There is no question that the second best thing that God ever gave me was the ability to forget. It says it in There Is a Solution. There'll come a day we'll be able to bring to our conscious memory with sufficient force. The best thing He ever gave me is an AA meeting where when I walk in the door, I'm reminded of every damn bit of it. Because I followed your rules and tools, the book and the steps, and today I don't walk in the shame of what I did. But I damn sure am reminded of it so I don't forget and I can give it away. Last year, my drinking was addictive. I drank a quart of whiskey a night and told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And I had to believe that. In 1975, my first wife kicked me out. She should have kicked me out years before. Hell, we never should have got married. That marriage was born out of hell. And let me tell you, no kidding. She didn't get a prize in me, but this was a romping, stomping bitch. This woman should have been shot. She hated my guts, and I hated her guts. Now, let me tell you why we got together. She was the first woman I ever slept with, freshman year in college. I was the first man. She told me this shit. I don't know whether I believe it or not. But I was the first man that she said she ever slept with, and I believe it because her religion said you got to marry him. My religion said you got to marry her. We didn't want to get married. We hated each other. We thought that was just the way it was supposed to be. We courted for 3 years, or we fought for 3 years. Then we got married, and we stayed married in pure hell for 17 years. Finally, I drank enough whiskey that she just couldn't put up with me. I didn't run around on her. Anything. I just was an asshole. So she kicked me out of the house. She kicked me out of the house, and I womanized and ran, drove white Corvettes, had a blue leisure suit on. Can't you see that blue leisure suit and white Corvette? I mean, I carried a sterling silver mint julep cup and a case of Chevy's Regal Scotch in the trunk of that. And when I got there, the party started. Can't you see? Hell, y'all done it. You know what I'm talking about. Come in there, and the party is ready, you know. I am here. And, oh, man, I had a ball because it was still working for me, you know, at that time. Then I met Casey, who is my wife, and she is undoubtedly the sweetest person who ever lived on God's earth. Her daddy was bipolar, and she watched her mother take care of her daddy. My mother was goofy, and I watched my daddy take care of my mother, and our pathology brought us together, and it worked. She's got one of the finest hearts I've ever known, and I think I do too. And it worked. I took care of her, she took care of me, and we drank together, drink for drink. We married, we had one date, and then I moved in with her. And that's the way, that's an alcoholic relationship. You know, I had one date and moved in with her. And we had a great life. She didn't get sick, and I got terribly sick, terribly fast. We got together in 1966, and I was in treatment in December of 77. And during that time, the rapidity of that disease just engulfed me. I can start any time of day at that last 6 months. I would get up at 11 o'clock. I didn't go to bed. I just sat in my big chair. Casey would come in and cry and say, please come to bed. And I'd say, I'm crazy and I'm going to drive you crazy. Get away from me. I am crazy and I'll make you crazy. And she'd cry and go to bed. And I would sit there and I'd try not to go to sleep because I thought if I don't go to sleep, I won't wake up. If I don't wake up, the day won't start. If the day doesn't start, all this won't have to happen again. So I said, but just don't go to sleep. That's the solution. Well, somewhere in there, I guess I passed out. Whatever I did, I'd get up at 11 o'clock. I'd take a Valium to stop shaking because, I was going into withdrawal all the time. And I'd race to the hospital, to my office, see my patients in about 2 or 3 hours. It normally took me 8 to 10. And then I'd run over and see my patients in the hospital. I didn't want to go when the real doctors were there. Then I would call Casey and she'd fix my scotch and water, my broil steak and baked potato. And I'd come home and eat my broil steak and baked potato because I knew I was tearing up my liver. Being a doctor, I knew I was tearing up my liver, but I couldn't quit drinking. And I'd get that eaten and sit down on the floor and turn on the first record, which was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. My eyes have seen, and I just sat there and cried and drank whiskey. Play that for about 8 or 10 hours. Then my second record was Neil Diamond's I Am, I said. And in that, now Neil Diamond was my hero, and this was in the 70s. Neil Diamond had a huge problem. My hero is talking to a chair, for God's sakes. But if you ever listen to that record, he said, "I've got an emptiness deep inside and it won't let me go. I'm not a man who liked to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone." That's the alcoholic lament, being alone in a crowd. What has impressed me is the spirit of camaraderie in this meeting. How many of you that didn't know somebody and you got here, now you know them better than you've known a lot of people all your life. And the ones who've come back each time and seen each other, you see that spirit come together. And we never have to be alone again. And that's the great grace. Many other gifts, but that's the great grace. Never, ever will Burns Brady have to be alone again. When I was drinking, I had to be alone at the end of my drinking. My story. That morning, she'd gotten up and gone to work. And I knew it was over. And I pray for each of us that day. I mean, I got up and I knew it was over. This is sometime between Thanksgiving and the 1st of December of 1977. I got up and there was complete surrender to it's over. Now, obviously, I didn't have a clue what to do about it. So I said, "God, help me." And immediately I knew what to do. And I walked into the bedroom, got me a 12-gauge shotgun, put it in my mouth, and I was going home. I really believed in God. God looked like a cross between Santa Claus and Charlton Heston and lived on a cloud. And sometimes today, my God is still a Santa Claus God. I love to curl up in Santa Claus's lap and put my head on his shoulder. It's much more than that. But there are days when that's just so sweet and so peaceful to do that. But I knew if I pulled that trigger, I would go home. The hook was, I didn't know how to bring this power into here. The very essence of what the big book says is lack of power. That is our dilemma. Lack of power. Only in the past 4 or 5 years have I really begun to touch with consistency and continuity that everything I do, including tonight, is because of the power that my God has given me. That's the way it is. The reason it took so long is I did wonderful things. You heard Bill talk to you about when he heard me 20 years ago. Hell, I told great stories. They were good. And they were as honest as I could be. And I really believed in God Almighty. But I never was able to differentiate, never even thought about it, whether it was me or God. Everything I do is because of God's power. And what a freedom to follow the rest of the drill, the responsibility to do His will as best I can. How can I best serve Thee? The seminal question in every part of my life today, right out of the 10th step, how can I best serve Thee? Everything I do, I look at a good-looking woman. I'm 71 years old, but live in the mind of a 25-year-old. And I see a good, or an 18-year-old, and I see a good-looking woman, I think, I can do this and get away with it. And the question is always the same. How can I best serve Thee? And I hear God's voice saying, "You arrogant little shit, turn around and go the other way." You know? He really never uses the word shit. Arrogant he throws in there a lot. Well, let me see if I can figure out where I was. Anyway, so I put the shotgun in my mouth, and I'm sitting there, and I really am ready to go home and have that peace. And I said, "God, if You don't want me to do this, give me a reason. Casey will be better off without me. My mother and dad will be better off without me. My patients will be better off without me." And I got to my children. I've got a daughter who's 47, who's been in AA 27 years, and a son who's 40, who's been in AA 22 years. At that time, they were babies. And I'd been in practice long enough to see people get impaled on what had they done wrong, that mother or daddy or somebody killed themselves. Why didn't they love them enough to stay? And I thought, my God, if I pull this trigger, those babies will never know why daddy didn't love them enough. What I learned years later in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is at that moment of complete self-absorption, because that's what suicide is for me. That's not a pejorative term. Complete self-absorption. I have the power. The power has failed. There is no other power. Why stay? And at that moment of complete self-absorption, my God, in all of His wisdom and glory, had me think of another human being. My children. In the eighth and ninth step, our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. Why are we here? We're in training. Every day in training. At least I am to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. Why am I here? I could be in Louisville tonight with my really good friends in an AA meeting and I would love it. I would have joy. I'm here because I'm capable physically to get here and somebody, maybe me, needs to hear this shit that I'm shooting to y'all. You know that? The interesting thing about that statement is, our primary purpose is to fit ourselves. It doesn't say to be of maximum service. It says to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. I am a good sponsor today. I'm a good sponsee today. I carry a hell of a message most of the time. And I'm showing up in God's army every time I get a chance. But there was a time when, with absolute ignorance, I did the same thing and I said I was a lethal weapon. Based on my experience, what I am imploring you to do is fit yourself. If you haven't done your step work, if you don't have a sponsor, then for God's sakes, don't sponsor anybody. You can drive them to a meeting. You can take them to a movie. And it's best it be of the same sex because you can get in a hell of a lot of trouble if it's of the opposite sex. But please, if you don't agree with what I'm saying, that's okay. But take it home, pray about it, and think about it. Fit yourself. For this day, I am fit to serve in God's army. On the front line, I've never been refused admission into God's army, but I've been sent to the classroom many, many times. Laid the gun down, the terror came back. I went to see a psychiatrist the next morning, and the first guy of my understanding was 5'9", stuttered and was a psychiatrist. I walked in, I said, David, send me somewhere. I'll do anything you tell me to do. And I mean, I was that way. I was that way for almost 2 years before, as T-Bolt said, the ego does arise unscathed. When the dust is settled and the crisis is over, the ego does arise unscathed. And I watched us all wade through it. Thank God for the steps that one day at a time we can deal with that. But for the first two years, I was completely teachable. I didn't play games with anybody. I was completely teachable. And the first guy of my understanding was the man I told you. Second guy of my understanding ran the treatment center that I got into. And there's a man in this room tonight that was my first exercise supervisor. And I did everything he told me to. He'd make me get on a bicycle. I was so physically shot that I could hardly climb on a damn stationary bicycle. But he'd put my little butt up there and I'd ride that bicycle. Because that's what he told me to do. I had multiple powers greater than myself that came in and that I followed beautifully. He sent me to New York. It took 3 weeks to detox me. Now, I don't say that proudly. I will say that I've seen other people that have taken longer just from alcohol. But this alcohol had me torn up. My liver was shot. My blood pressure was shot. I mean, I was in really bad shape. Took a long time to get me in decent shape, and they sent me to Atlanta, to a treatment center in Atlanta. I spent 2 months down there and then went home. I got home and came into AA in Louisville when it was the best of times for AA, and it was the worst of times. It was the best of times because of the fellowship. The fellowship was indescribably wonderful, literally. There were 6 or 8 of us, and we were joined at the hip, and our wives came with us. We cooked out at our homes on weekends. Yeah, we went to 4 and 5 structured meetings, but we lived this program damn near 24/7. As couples and as individuals. I used to say we were the little pygmy elephants. If the first elephant stopped, every other person got a brown nose because we were just like this. And let me tell you why that was extremely important, because I've listened to some of the speakers in here talk about it, and you may not recognize it, but there's a thing called the post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Wilson was the first person in history to describe it. Nobody knew what he was describing. He didn't know. He said for a year and a half he couldn't get a job because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. Medical science proved this in 1979. Short-term memory, antegrade, will be screwed up for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving, stress management, sleep patterns can be screwed up for 6 months to 2 years. Hell, I couldn't read the Courier Journal and remember it. I could practice medicine because it's antegrade. What I'd done in learning to ride a bicycle was here. I'd read journals and couldn't remember. Hell, I'd read the big book or read my meditation book, lay it down and couldn't remember it. And I'd just cry because I thought I'd ruined my brain. I would go to see the psychiatrist I was seeing. I'd go on Thursday when I'd been there on Tuesday. And I'd say, where do you want me to start, Homer? He said, start where we were on Tuesday. I can't remember where we were. You're blocking your therapy again. Oh, shit, I'm blocking my therapy again. And then I'd go into to the AA meeting. Anybody got a problem? I got a problem. What's your problem? I'm blocking my therapy. And they'd have me tell them the story. And then one of the old-timers say, Burns, you remember where his office is? And I'd say, yeah. And he said, son, that's as good as it's going to get for about 2 years. That's as good as it's going to get for about 2 years. It was the, and I'll tell you what else was good. Because of that syndrome, I would call my sponsor 5 and 6 and 7 times a day from my office. I would go in and examine patients, and that'd be fine. Come out and be walking from one examining room to another and sit there and just start shaking and just crying and go into my inner office, pick up the phone. I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. Did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Did you get the office on time? Yeah. You going to eat your lunch? Yeah. You coming to the meeting tonight? Yeah. You'll be fine. Thanks, Jim. I felt great. 30 minutes later, Jim, I'm flying apart. Did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Never said shit they'll publish, but it really did everything perfect for me. It quieted it down. That voice quieted it down. And if you're in that frame of mind or if you're in that spectrum, never underestimate the power and spirituality in that voice. In that voice. And that's my experience. Things went along just fine. I got to be Mr. AA, Mr. Dr. AA. I told you I hadn't read the book, wasn't doing the steps. Casey was my indentured servant. She and I ran everywhere together. She went to Al-Anon, then we went to open meetings together. I put her right on my hip. I sent her new clothes every season. Didn't ask her what kind she wanted. I sent her a new car every 2 years. Didn't ask her what kind she wanted. Took her on wonderful vacations. Never asked her where she wanted to go. And we had great sex because we did everything I wanted to do. And then Casey came to me when she came into AA and said, Burns, I'd like to go to school. I'd like to go back to college. Fine, honey. Go back to college. She hadn't been back in college but about 3 months till I was one of the most pissed off people on the face of God's earth. She wasn't taking care of me and making... This is a relationship issue, guys. Listen real clearly. I don't know how many of you are there, but I venture to say damn near every one of you who hadn't already walked through and looked at it. My caretaker had abandoned me. The old history of do what mama wants you to do, give her everything she wants, and she'll take care of you and make you feel special. Casey is now abandoning me. She's not turning the lights on at home when I get there. She hadn't gotten my supper fixed when I get there. The bitch has abandoned me. I still loved her, but I mean, I was just so angry. So what do we do when we don't have a caretaker? I'll tell you what I did. I got me one. 10 years in sobriety with this wonderful woman that I adored, I had a 3-month affair. It tore me up for 5 years, but I had a 3-month affair. Then I realized that I was going to get drunk because I hadn't told anybody. I really believed you got to be honest with no secrets because I kept how it works every time. So I went and told my sponsor. I said, Jim, I'm having an affair. And he said, quit. I said, okay. So I left and went home. By the time I got home, he'd called my wife and told her. Now, when I'm working with the men at the heating place, 175 of them, most of them been in prison, and I say, what should I do? You should have shot the son of a bitch. That's what you ought to have done. That's the normal instinct, isn't it? Now I can say, let's see where God took this. Let's see where God took this. Because obviously I couldn't be with Jim anymore, and he'd been making all my decisions. And I left and I went out and I cried and I cried. Within 1 week I changed all of my meetings. I said, God, please help me. And about that time, a little spawn. Never, if you want to get help, don't. If you ask for it, you better be ready. Little sponsee came up in mind with Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I cried all the way through them because I saw a 12-step program, not a 3-step program. And I'd lived 10 years on a 3-step program. I had all three of those steps the day I took that shotgun out of my mouth. I did not know that's what it was. And after I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I saw the spiritual experience that I'd had with those 3 steps. I said, God, why'd you leave me out here? You could have changed all this. Why'd you leave me out here? I felt His voice say, you may impress a lot of people with what you know, but you're going to help heal a lot of people by your experience. I loved you enough, and I knew you loved me enough. Take this to them. Tell them what it's like to live on a 3-step program, and tell them what it's like to live on a 12-step program, because they'll listen, because that's what you've experienced. And that's exactly what I experienced. I had 11 copies made, and 12 of us got down, and for 6 months we read our book and did our steps with each other. Right now there are at least 45 big book studies in Louisville, Kentucky at all times, and it grew out of that. And I rejoice in it. I asked Geraldine Delaney one time, I don't know, she's older than God and died older than God, sober older than God, I think. And I asked Ms. Delaney, has AA changed? Because Wilson said AA must and will change. In his last talk, which he didn't give, but he said, AA must and will change. I said, has it changed? She said, yeah. How's it changed, Miss Delaney? It changed because right when she came in, she said there were at least 2 or 3 old-timers for every newcomer. She said, now you have to remember, Burns, they might not have more than 2 or 3 years of sobriety, but they were old-timers. She said, now there's at least 30 or 40 newcomers for every old-timer. We must figure out how to carry the message. It's going to be less and less that we'll have one-on-one sponsorship doing the steps with their sponsee, just from the pure volume. And I rejoice when I get a chance to do that. But I do 4 big book studies a week in Louisville, Kentucky, other than my normal 4 meetings. Because I finally said, Ms. Delaney, should this be what I do? Try it. God didn't want you to do it. He'll shut you down. And man, I have seen the Spirit happen in the people who listen, but most of all in me, because I know this book, I use this book, I live this book, I truly do, to deal with a really screwed up son of a gun. Me. The worst of times, it was the best of times because of the fellowship, is the worst of times because of the book. When I got into the book, I realized that my problem is not alcohol. My problem is my thinking. Wilson called it the peculiar mental twist. The drink occurs on Saturday night. The relapse started 6 months ago with the way I think. And it's that thinking like that. It's never this. The lie, boom, oh no. It's the subtlety. Alcohol is subtle. Cunning, baffling, powerful doesn't say much to me. Subtle says everything. Come dressed in its best clothes. The devil always does. And for me, it'll be a brand new Corvette, a good-looking, swarthy female, and a $10 bill. And I'm fucked. Somebody says, what do you do when they come in? I said, I go out the other door. Why don't you use your spirituality? I just did. I said, God, what do you want me to do? Go out the back door. That's not running. That's just going to something. And it ain't what came in the front door either. Wilson believed in the peculiar mental twist so much I began to look at it. The best story in the big book about the peculiar mental twist has to do with Jim's story. And you go down and watch how that peculiar mental twist consumed him with resentments, with self-pity, with anger, with all of it. And judgment decisions until he believed the lie. The only solution, and I'll tell you quickly because my time is getting up. The peculiar mental twist is this, for me, bigger than the rules. AA has rules. Silkworth said, if these men follow a few simple rules, we have rules. Bigger than the rules is self-centeredness, and I watch people get drunk with them all the time. And I watch me get crazy when I don't follow the rules. The rules are simple for me. 11th step, the third step, and the seventh step in the morning. The 10th step throughout the day that leads me to all the other steps. And close tonight when I go to bed with the 11th step. Just the way it's written. I can screw up a one-car parade. But if I keep it that simple and that focused, I don't screw up that parade. That simple and that focused. That simple and that focused. The only solution, and the second piece of that is victimization. Victimization, he called self-pity and resentment. You know, I think the IRS has really got it out for Burns Brady. I'm sure the Louisville Courier Journal does. Most of you in this room who don't like my talker, it's because you really don't like me. I mean, you just basically hate my guts. I mean, you would like to see me dead. And you're sitting there thinking, hell, who gives a shit about him that bad, you know? But that's the way I think. They're all out to screw me. And finally, square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg doesn't fit in the round hole, beat it till it fits. That's called control. Fear-based. There will be those of us in this room who will drink again. And not a one of us will drink because we don't believe the first half of the first step. We will drink again because we don't buy the second half of the first step. Every problem I've got comes out of the second half of the first step. And every solution I've got is a 12-step solution. Not 4 and 5, not 6 and 7, not 8 and 9, not 12, not 10, not 11. It's a 12-step solution for a first-step problem. The only answer is spiritual. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I will tell you two stories if I can cram them in before I have to get off. First one has to do with about 5 years ago, I went to see my sponsor and we went to see a psychiatrist that knows me well, and my wife went in with me, and I said, I know joy, I know happiness, I really revel in where I am, but I've never known peace. They said, well, we know you, you've got the best program we've ever seen, we don't know what to tell you. I said, maybe this is where it's supposed to be. So I began to study Bill Wilson and I found it. In 1940, Ed Dowling came to meet Bill Wilson in New York. Dowling was a Jesuit priest, and Wilson and Dowling were this close for 20 years, 40 to 60. Hadn't been for Ed Dowling, I'm not sure what would have happened to Wilson or what would have happened to our program. He was an absolute incredible influence. And Dowling went to see Wilson because the 12 steps he had found were the Ignatian spiritual exercises distilled into their simplest essence. And he went to see him. How much time have I got? 5 minutes? So he went in. See that there? I got you. So he went. He went in to see that. He went in to see Wilson because he wanted to see this man who'd written 12 steps. And as he went in on November, it was in November of 1940. And history doesn't tell us where Lois was. They were on 24th Street. Wilson was upstairs laying on the bed. And you know what he was doing? Same thing I was doing tonight before this start. He thought his ulcer was coming back. Wilson was a major hypochondriac, always, all of his life, histrionic and hypochondriac. My great hero, but that's what he was. He was laying up there with his stomach gnawing at him because they didn't have any money. The whole world was blowing up in his face. The whole deal was just going south, in his opinion, based on what he thought he'd get out of it. So the caretaker came up and said, there's someone here to see you, Bill. And he said, send him up. So he could hear Dowling tape his cane tapping on the floor as he came in. Here's Dowling, had on an overcoat, 5'4", Wilson 6'3" or 6'4", looking down at him. He said, take off your coat and let's talk. When Dowling took off his coat, he saw the collar. And they sat down and began to talk, and they fell in love. And I mean, thank God they fell in love. And in the middle of that conversation, Wilson said to Dowling, will I ever know peace? And Dowling says, no. He said, why? He said, because you've been blessed with divine dissatisfaction. He said, your seeking will bring people to the light. And one day you will know the light. And all of a sudden what I thought was my worst, worst, worst character defect was my greatest gift. Isn't that true most of the time? I have come to know peace. My first entry was when I realized, when I really feel that total peace is when I'm looking in at newcomer's eyes, and I realize he sees me, I see him, and we both know. and that's peace. It's now beginning to be sustained as I've surrendered to God's power around the clock, through the steps, the spiritual awakening, through the steps. They live in me 24/7. Whatever time it took, that's where it is. Final story, my daddy. My mother died in 78. I made my amends to mother. I've been sober 8 months. Then I went to try, and she died, and God, what a glorious death, and what a wonderful relationship. My daddy was one of the gentlest, kindest men I've ever known. He was a powerful man, but he was gentle and kind. He truly was the best man I've ever known. And I wanted my daddy to tell me it was okay. And I'd try to make my amends to daddy, and he'd say, "Son, I can't talk to you about it." I said, "Why?" "Well, I didn't know till he died." And my stepmother and daddy died married about a year after mother died. And my stepmother told me when daddy died in 92 that daddy wouldn't talk to me because he was ashamed, not of me, of him. He thought he had caused my alcoholism. So I would try to tell daddy I was sorry, and daddy'd say, "Please, Burns Mac, I don't want to talk about it." My sponsor pulled me off of him and said, "Quit trying to do that. That's just for your peace of mind." So daddy then developed Alzheimer's disease. It really is micro-infarct dementia. Works the same way, but basically. And daddy forgot me, forgot mother, forgot my brother, forgot everybody. And we put him in a nursing home because that's where he needed to be. And I was 14 years sober at this time. Casey and I had gotten into therapy. I'd made my amends to everybody. We were building this marriage back on a better basis than it's ever been long. She had a strong 12-step program. I had a strong 12-step program. We brought it together and lived a 12-step program together. Magnificent. Magnificent. I have been tempted since then. I have strayed. I've never slept with anybody since then, but I've made spiritual commitments to other people. And thank God I was rescued before I went out and played in the traffic. They think I've got a sexual addiction. Hell, I don't have a sexual addiction. I just think about it all the time. But anyway. So we put Daddy in a nursing home, and I went down there to see Daddy, and all this miracle was happening in my life, but I just didn't know it. I was in the middle of it, and I'd drive 250 miles home, and I'd think, "God, take away my pain," and I'd go in, work with Daddy, come back home, cry all the way back. Didn't work. This one Sunday, I drove in, parked the car, and said, "God, let me be for my Daddy what you want me to be." I walked in, he was in a wheelchair, and he called me Buster, his brother. And I said, "Hal," didn't call him Daddy, that confused him. I said, "Hal, can I help you?" He said, "Yeah, Buster, would you shave me?" And I shaved Daddy. I said, "Would you like to go out and eat some lunch?" He said, "I believe I would," and I fed him because he was basically too weak to feed himself. Peggy came in and sat down, and she and I got to talking, and Daddy used to love to watch Mother and me talk. He'd just sit there watching and watching. He didn't say a word, and I said, "Would you like to go out on the porch, Hal?" He said, "I believe I would," and I rolled him out there. Peggy and I got to talking and talking. He raised up in his wheelchair, and he looked at me, and he said, "Son, today you dislike the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me." Now, let me tell you, the miracle of that is not that my daddy recognized me. Follow me, and you'll know this. Because as a doctor, I can tell you what happened. The miracle is that this self-centered individual, alcoholic, instead of saying, "Take away my pain," said, "Let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." You are my heroes. I love you from the bottom of my heart. What a joy and privilege to have spent this party with you. Good night.